You're listening to Confessing Animals with Jen Harris and Vanessa Arrigo, rebel poets, real rebels, really talking poets, rebelling and listening.
Okay, don't interrupt me.
Hey everyone, welcome to season 3 of Confessing Animals podcast. I'm your host, Jen Harris, and today we will be joined by our other host, our beloved co-host, Vanessa Arrigo. She is also the artist that we are interviewing today for our first episode of season 3, Revenge is Revolution. And just to introduce you to Vanessa, in case you don't know, Vanessa Arrigo is a multimedia poet and co-host of Confessing Animals, an interview-style podcast discussing creativity with writers and artists. Her work includes 2 poetry albums, The Midnight Rush and Human Animal. She is a Charlotte Street Foundation studio resident 2019 to 2022 in Kansas City, Missouri. Her work can be found at vanessaarrigo.com and at Petanella Winters on Instagram. And we'll drop all the links in the show notes. I hope you enjoy today's interview with Vanessa.
I think of revenge, I think of revolution. Because, okay, so I just want to throw this out there because it's going to like shape kind of like the arc of this conversation.
Absolutely. But throw it out there.
So Nietzsche, philosopher.
I love that you're starting us off with Nietzsche. I'm sorry.
I have to, you know, whatever anyone thinks about him, this guy had some great ideas. So he says, revenge is nothing but repetition. And the human condition, essentially, our revenge is against time because we all die, right? So I love how broad this is, putting this in the spectrum of revenge against time, our immortality, and repetition, which, you know, coincides with his idea of the eternal recurrence, the eternal return. It's in a lot of his work, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, and... The Gay Science, it kind of, you know, is incorporated in a lot of his work. But I loved that idea of thinking of it as repetition because our lives are so cyclical. And I remember being very young and seeing the cycle of my life. I'm like, I felt it coming up again. I'm like, okay, I could walk through the same door and keep repeating this behavior or however my life is going, or I could choose not to walk through that door and find close the door. I can walk through another door. And it was a very conscious, like, here it comes. I'm not going to do this again, right? So in the cycle of our lives, in the repetition of living, in the repetition of everything comes back, whether it's this lifetime or other lifetimes, you know, there's a way to do it different, though. You know what I mean? Like, the revolution comes in, yes, I'm doing the same thing, but I'm going to do it different, right? Like, and I don't
Absolutely.
Really...
We learn from our mistakes. We learn from our history, like starting on the revolution being different, right? Like, I was watching someone the other day, I don't remember who or where or what, but he said, you know, a small army is much bigger if they have access to the right technology. And I was like, yeah, that's how they shut down that fucking oil pipeline on the East Coast. Like, go fuck yourselves. We can do whatever we want from a computer. And that was extraordinary to me. That's a different type of revolution, right?
Right.
The Fight Club introduced this notion initially of like, it's not so much the, I don't think Fight Club introduced it. Let me just correct myself. But you can blow up a building or you can figure out a way to decimate their system from the inside. You know what
right.
I mean? You can delete all the files as opposed to costing human life. And like, in my opinion, that's the way we shut down capitalism in general. Figure out their code and dismantle it, you know?
Right.
Cyber attacks are the new war. And that's what's so wild about it. But I think this conversation of revenge and redemption, and specific to you saying revenge is repetition, is so interesting because I think that's my greatest weapon over the last like almost decade of my life has been like, don't fuck with me. I'll write about this shit and I'll put it up on the stage. And then everybody will know what a dumb bitch you are. So get off me. Right. And I've written 3 books now of like the wrongs that have been done to me. And I think I'm coming out of that too, right? Like I was looking at my work over 2020 coupled with this intense amount of therapy. And I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe how many things about me that are so deeply personal that I revealed to the world. And there was this moment where I was like, I want to pull all these books offline. I want to take it all back. I don't want anybody to see me like this. Because I started with the rawest truths that I could possibly contain as a person and put those out there. But at the time, it was the only way for me to heal. Right. So like I was getting mine by telling the truth over and over and over again. Just like, I'm going to say this until I no longer need a witness to it.
Oh, that's so powerful. And when I think of repetition also, there's so many good points. Like, repeating the same story, and I've heard a lot of writers say this, like every single book of mine is basically about the same thing. A lot of writers find this one topic and they're forever interrogating and reinterpreting and rewriting and viewing it. And I think that's so important. I've begun to notice that in myself, in my writing, and saying it again and again on stage, saying it again and again in your books reminds me of like going to therapy and saying it again and again until it transforms. And have you ever noticed like when you repeat the same word over and over again, it eventually turns to mush. It sounds funny. It sounds different. It no longer like really means anything. Right. So it's like, I love all these aspects of repetition and how eventually change comes out of the repetition.
Well, and sometimes you just get tired of hearing yourself talk, you know, like I'm a verbal processor. So when I got some shit on my mind, I need to yell it, spout it, get it all out. And then I have struggled in the past with people being like, how could you say those things? Just because you think them and I say them doesn't mean we're any different. Exactly. I'm saying them, let's say, in the privacy of my home, unloading all the bullshit I feel about said person, said subject, said experience. Because I need to exercise all of these things out of me in order to like, you know, like Pema Chodron talks about, you know, that which remains is indestructible. And I think about that all the time. Just like all this stuff has got to come out so that I can get to the origin, to the root of what it is that's bothering me in the first place. But absolutely. I think it's to your point. Was it Cézanne that painted the same mountain over and over and over again from like the same window, I think?
Oh, yeah. I was just reading about that recently.
Yeah, there's that concept of like viewing the subject over the course of you being the time, you know, like time and the subject coinciding. So every season, you know, every light, every time of day or night, and over decades and decades of like, I'm looking at this same thing. How is it changing? How am I changing? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, you know, that's where this specific area of our conversation, I think, overlaps is like, I'm changing. Yeah. I cannot be unchanged by what's happened to our country, to our world. And I'm forced into change by what's happened to our economic probability of success, because I was already in a really narrow margin of making it in any major way as an artist. And not to be disheartened, I stopped believing that I would be a fabillionaire at some point. I also don't want to be one of those people. I mean, I would like to be financially comfortable, but that's $100,000 a year. That's not millions of dollars. I mean, I used to think that like they had to be a huge ass price tag attached to my comfort. And it turns out $45,000 a year is totally acceptable. I'm completely comfortable. Anything over that is like, we balling out. I can do anything I can possibly conceive of. I don't want a fucking jet.
Exactly.
I want a vacation, you know, on a seasonal basis. That's what I want.
I know we have this conversation all the time. It's like, you know, especially with Ashley's music, it's like, we're not wanting jets and flying into places and houses. And like, we could live on so little, like the modesty.
We do live on so little.
And the modesty, though, of even like our loftiest dreams, like when we're just like, you know, it's so small still. Like if we had $100,000, we felt like, oh my God, I'd be set for life, right? Like you think of all these things. It's like when you're so used to living on nothing, and when you think of the consistency of what $100,000 is, you think like, how could you possibly need more? Like we want, I don't know. I value so much more like on experience and creation more than like things, right? Like I don't want to live in a big house. Like I don't even want the upkeep of a big house. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
girl, I've lived in a big house. I don't need three goddamn bathrooms and four stories to clean up. Like I need a ranch with two bathrooms. One of those is the master. You know,
right. It's like when I'm already comfortable shitting outside, like you can only imagine like my level of comfort doesn't like really require much above that.
Listen, I think that the height of my luxury would be having a pool, like either a saline or a natural pool. Cause I'm not trying to do all that chlorine, you know, nature murder, but like,
oh my God, nature murder. Can that be our next spinoff podcast?
The ways in which we could just be big bummers the whole time. Like this is how we're wrecking the fucking earth. And we just want to point it out to you as I'm like sipping my Starbucks coffee.
Oh, I love this.
Of the problem. Well, today is our conversation about revenge and redemption. And based on audience request, we're going to interview each other. But today, this episode is starting with interviewing you, and your subject is revenge. So,
of course,
you've already brought Nietzsche into the conversation. Of fucking course you did. And we're going to talk about a lot of stuff. I want to look at, God, where the fuck do we even start? Okay. Fuck it. Before we do anything else, we're going to get into listening to your piece, Should I Bow Down and Weep, which is really the cornerstone of our conversation centralized around interviewing you, one, Vanessa Errico, talking about your work, and also bringing this season three theme to life. So you are focused on revenge, and we're going to listen to the piece, Should I Bow Down and Weep?
Should I bow down and weep at the sight of the holy face? Wise and pale, does she even care, my knees naked and flayed? Before you, am I supposed to care, your words meaningless, burnt, removed from freedom, taken from your own mythology, wept, packed away, labored, tell the truth harder. I wear my nervous crown upon my head. Rings of terror befall my body electric. Sweeping magnetic halos signaling the mind to reach for something greater than itself. Captured by the waves' autonomous smells. Revenge is never as one hopes. Baroque.
All right. First of all, you're smarter than me in every way. And I'm always looking for these hidden nuggets. Like I'm trying to truly understand your work and getting directly into Should I Bow Down and Weep? I feel like specifically on the theme of revenge, I want to poke at, should I care? You're asking this question. Should I care? Am I supposed to feel bad about committing an act of revenge? Am I supposed to turn myself over to a higher power and suffer for my choices? Is it human to suffer for revenge? Like, why do you start with the question, should I care?
I'm going to make two confessions here since this is called Confessing Animals. One, this poem is on my album, Human Animal, which I think was released in 2018, maybe. And it was probably written even before that. So there's a lot of distance sometimes between like when I write a poem, when it's recorded, when it's released, and when maybe I'm actually even discussing it. As soon as we decided revenge and redemption, this poem popped up in my head. Obvious reasons, it ends with, revenge is never as one hopes, Baroque. I have no idea what the fuck this poem means.
Well, I mean, ironically.
But wait.
Go ahead.
Yeah. A lot for me, and not so much recently, because like you mentioned before, I feel like a lot of my style and a lot of my writing has changed and is becoming more intentional. Before, a lot of my writing is about like how it sounds. It's a very, the words sounded right. Like, but also, and I've mentioned this before, there is a river that is constantly floating around me, and call it the muse. I'm a Gemini. So call it, you know, I'm the sign of communication. Whatever it is, I feel I have access to something that is around and I just pluck it and put it down. So sometimes I don't even feel like I am the author of these poems. Sometimes I'm the like translator almost, right? And when I revisited this, I'm just like, a lot of it to me sounds amazing, but I know where a lot of this came from, right? Like most people, it's very, you know, autobiographical. But I also like to do a lot of questioning in my work. I'm questioning myself. I'm questioning like the nature of things, how things really are. So should I bow down and weep at the sight of the holy face? Like, I don't believe in God. I was not raised with religion, right? But I've noticed I use a lot of like religious like iconography and language, and you know, because it's how our culture is formed, right? Like it informs our culture, I should say. But a lot of it's just these universal themes. You know, when I think of revenge as revolution, a lot of it's not personal. A lot of it is just on a larger scale, right? Of capitalism, of patriarchy, of just how our system is run, how people are treated so badly, how religion abuses people. All of it is constantly like, I feel like I'm rebuking, or it's my rebuttal, or like I am having a conversation with the world. I'm having a conversation with this imaginary God, if it's there, right? Now, the second part, I wear my nervous crown upon my head. I know specifically where that came from. I had an ex, but he wrote this song about how I may be royalty and he may be scum, and like make sure I put on my crown before I go into town. You know, just that image that he wrote in that song about like me wearing this crown because I think I'm royalty, and coupling that with like my anxiety, I just imagine putting on like this nervous crown. I like pairing words like that, like a nervous crown. Like you wouldn't normally describe a crown as being nervous, right? But everything's metaphor. Everything's symbolic for me in my writing, right? I think revenge is symbolic, you know? I don't want to actively like go harm somebody. When I think of revenge, it's on the page. It's symbolic. It's, you know, getting it out. I end with revenge is never as one hopes, Baroque. And I had a very Baroque period. I have this title, like 1,000 Baroque Orgasms. It's this book I'll forever be writing. But I use Baroque as a play on the word broke. Like I'm a broke ass bitch. I'm poor, right? Like, but things are broken, right? Like, but here it is very much of the Baroque style, of the ornamental, of the excess, of, you know, because we're all shown revenge as like this glorifying thing in movies and television, right? Like we all hate violence, but our entertainment is 100% nothing but violence, right? So it's like things are never as they seem, basically.
Well, working backwards in this piece, like I definitely understand being a conduit, right? Like I don't know why I have been chosen as a download for the conversation of the ethos, but that's how I understand myself, right? And like this notion from the Greeks of like genius visits you rather than you're in possession of genius was always so deeply relieving to me, because cool, then I don't have to nurture genius and creativity. It comes to me when it wants to. It dumps its workload on me. Working backwards in your piece, though, revenge is never as one hopes, Baroque. I deeply tried to understand this on a literal level. So, like, I was like, well, what the fuck is Baroque, first of all? And the thing that I took away from it is that this Baroque period, this art, these mannerisms are characterized by ornate detail. So when I read the line, "Revenge is never as one hopes, Baroque," I read it's ornate, it's detailed, it's complicated, it's complex. And working my way through this piece from top to bottom, the "Should I bow down and weep at the sight of the holy face?" I immediately was like, well, what is it that you're carrying? What confession are you being forced to exercise in some way? And then I was like, maybe this is a poem about abortion, because I directly connected it in my own mind. Comedian Michelle Wolf talks about her, the experience she had with having an abortion. And she talks about, like, I went in, I had the procedure, I drank half a LaCroix, and I went back to work. And she's like, it only matters if it matters to you. It can mean everything. It can mean nothing. But that's a personal decision. And there's a whole society out there that's like, you should feel bad and ashamed and suffocated by this decision the rest of your life. And no matter what choice you make, they want you to feel that way, right? So whether you terminate this pregnancy or you carry it through for its entire adulthood, you're fucked, because everybody's going to be making judgments about the decisions you make. Right. So when I'm reading this piece, that's where it took me, was like this anthem of should I feel sorry? Should I care? Should I believe? Do I, you know, your words meaningless, burnt, removed from freedom, taken from your own mythology, like all of this notion and suffering and this duty to personal debilitation, it seems to come out in this poem to me as at the ultimate bottom line, like, do I have to care? Is this something I have to go through? Do I have to participate in this? Or are you making me? And then the "I wear my nervous crown upon my head" felt very like I hold myself in high regard as a human being, but everybody around me is making me nervous that I shouldn't have this much confidence, this much intentionality behind my living, this many opinions. You know, you have both a vagina and a big mouth. So, you know, like, are you allowed to coexist within those things? Or is that juxtaposition what truly makes you who you are against this culture that we live in? Like, I read so deeply into this because I like personalizing poetry. I'm like, Mary Oliver wrote everything for me, about me. You know what I mean?
Yes. I love this reading of this poem so much. And honestly, it's all I could hope for. And sometimes when I get nervous about the abstraction of my poetry, that it might not be accessible to people, this is where I think it's really beneficial, because you created like this wonderful meaning and this wonderful story. And, you know, I may not even know what the hell this poem means, even when I wrote it, because it just sounded good and it came out of my mouth. I don't know. Obviously there's deeper meanings. Obviously I was inspired by things, right? But as it comes out, as I have presented it, like, I want there to be different readings of it. I want, yes, of course, that's what the poem means. It also means whatever someone else's interpretation of it. And I think that's successful.
We're really wrecking people's notions right now, because it's like, you know, they tell you not to meet your idols because you'll find out they're fucking grumpy ass humans like the rest of us are.
Right.
And you could catch them on a particularly bad day and shatter your whole understanding of them. Like, I love the idea of somebody being like, this is the most important poem I've ever read in my entire life. And now this bitch is saying it doesn't mean anything at all. It means whatever I make it mean. And like, that's kind of the value of our artwork, right? Is like, I suck at being commissioned to write about something. It is, right. I've done it a million times over now, but when someone tells me, well, the general theme is, and we want you to write, you know, something that's going to burn the house down, never do I feel more pressure, and never do I feel more like I'm floundering, because right. I can't infuse meaning into writing. Only the reader can do that.
It feels fake too, right? Like, if I feel like I'm forcing some kind of agenda, or like, you know, when someone's asked, and like, maybe I don't feel like so authentic. And I think maybe that's why, like, I haven't been as intentional of a writer as I'd like to be, but I'm learning to be, is because I felt like if it didn't naturally just come to me, then like somehow I wasn't being real or something. I don't really know. Like, I don't have any like philosophies or truths that I uphold in myself or my writing. Like, I've always been a writer, you know, like, it just happens. Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, this never, it hasn't been a conscious thing. And it's really interesting just like revisiting like older work, or like trying to figure out like, what did I mean there? Like, what was going on? Like, you know, I don't know. I like it. And I don't, and I hope that I don't want to demystify anything for anybody. And I also, I think we have too much access to artists right now. Like, there's been so many times where I have been turned off on social media from like a writer, an artist, whoever that I might be, whose work that I like, but then like I see their personality and like things they post or things they say, I'm like, ew, like, and I'm turned off. And then like, I'm just
big
like,
same.
Yeah. And I don't want to do that, but like, I also like having these types of conversations. So it's like, okay, so I might be outing myself saying like, I have no idea what my poem even fucking means. But like, I also think like, it's a win for me that your reading of it and what you said back to me, like, I think that's beautiful. I love it.
Well, I love it too. And it felt like such a really a powerful piece that encompassed whatever a person needed to get out of it, they got out of it. Right. And I really wanted to understand it at a ground level. Because as a writer, I know that I slip nuance, and like when you were like, I know exactly where that nervous crown line comes from. You know, I know that I've written people into my work, written memories, history, lovers, fights, whatever it is, in obscure ways. I've written like the whole sentence out and cut it down to four words that summarizes this without giving you the person or the place. And so I'm looking for the subtlety and the nuance in a way that almost pisses off the person who went to college, because I was like, fuck literary criticism. I don't want them dissecting my work. My work means exactly what the fuck it says it means. Like, don't try to infuse meaning in it. And then I realized, oh, what I'm actually saying is I don't want people to come looking inside of me for meaning. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to go excavating my truths. I want them to find themselves in my work and make it mean whatever it means to them. So in that, I can completely respect the process of like, I don't know, it came out of me and it shapeshifts depending on whose hands it's in. Like, that's
right. Well, also
completely acceptable.
I have the luxury of having the musical component to it, right? Like, the first work I've ever put out into the world has been these two published poetry albums. My first one was The Midnight Rush, and the second one is Human Animal. And I'm lucky. I'm lucky that I have a partner, Ashley Rains, who is not only like my life partner, but is also my creative partner. And I never liked the sound of my voice. I also never, like, didn't want to deliver poetry and like a formal way, because I knew the minute you say poetry, a lot of people just like kind of shut down.
I saw it live and in person last night. Where
right.
Like, oh, it's
right.
Ugh.
Yeah. And like, and I'm guilty. I've been like that in the past too. Like, I've had that kind of response. Like, so to me, it's like, I always wanted to find a different medium to deliver these poems. Right. And I've always been a big fan of Patti Smith. So, you know, like if I couldn't have been the one to make, you know, horses, then like I was going to do my damnedest to like live in that universe of Patti Smith. Right. And so, of course, I partnered with a musician and he brought my shit to life. You know what I mean? Like, I had an idea and I said, I want this. And then he created it. And to me, that's love. Like, when I think of like, I don't need you to financially take care of me. I don't need you to do, like, when I think about what matters to me, the fact that like someone spent the time to create beautiful music to bring my artwork to life, like, wow, that's a partnership to me. Like, that's what I've been really grateful for, because like, I couldn't do that. Like, I can't make music. Like, it's added a dimension of my work that I've always wanted, that I always envisioned for myself, you know, and I get to have it. And like, I don't care, like, maybe two people have listened to it, but like, I'm so proud of these albums. I'm so proud of this work. I'm so proud of the creative partnership I have with Ashley. Like, he, the cool thing, this is my favorite part of it. So he's been a singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist since like the late 90s, right? He's an Americana singer-songwriter. Like, his music couldn't be more different than what my poetry albums are for. And that's what even feels more special. He didn't just do, you know, he plays Weissenborn, this amazing hollow neck lap steel guitar. Like,
what's it called?
A Weissenborn.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's like, I think it's initially a Hawaiian instrument. It's really beautiful. Anyways, he has a custom made one. Like, he has like the Ashley Raines Weissenborn. But like, he didn't make his sound. He didn't offer his work as it was. Like, he created something for me, which I feel like he does a lot with our podcast too. Like, he's not putting, it's his music, but like, he's creating it for the podcast. It's not his, he's a very dark Americana singer-songwriter. He has like a deep voice. He's very much a Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, you know, Tom Waits kind of guy, right? And yeah, that's not what my albums sound like. Like, they're very avant-garde. They're very experimental. They're very me and electric. What I asked for. Yeah. Like, the first album was so cool. Like, he, you know, it's mostly all, you know, instruments that he played. But, like, also, we, like, got the vacuum cleaner. And we got, like, pots and pans. We got, like, the drill bits. Like, we did all these, like, really cool, you know, tangible sounds, right? And then the second album is all electronic. So, you know, who knows what teenage poetry is going to be like. I keep telling him, like, clean out the garage so we can, like, actually be a garage band and, like, figure out this teenage poetry thing.
I love the intentionality and the creativity that's involved in getting to the sound in the first place, right? Like, in my own experience with that, it was my ex-partner who was a painter offering up her studio to me and saying, like, let me teach you how to make chapbooks, right? So we saddle stitched and we grommeted and we painted and we texturized, and like, she introduced me to all of these materials that were further conduits for my work, things that I would have never had the history, the time, or quite frankly, the money at that point, with all the different elements of what I used from her studio to then present my work in this package. And this package was beautiful and handmade, and, you know, it was stamped and pressed and embossed, and like, it was so much more alive because of that creative collaboration. I think that that's what really drove me to being like, if I can hold this chapbook in my hand, I can hold a published book in my hand. And honestly, the chapbook creation was way more fun. Yeah. I mean, significantly more expensive, and never am I going to recover the money from that. But right, it was two people coming together and saying, let's take this one thing and make something even more beautiful out of it. And I didn't have that vision to follow through with that element. I could right, only write the words. But then when someone says, like, do you want to, you know, engrave your book title on this strip of metal, or do you want to gold leaf it? I was like, oh yeah, I do. Yeah. But I want somebody to show me how to do that. Like, lead me to it and then let me play. But right, I don't, I mean, I am a certain type of artist. I'm a writer. So
yeah,
I don't have all this other shit laying around. Like, let me into your world and let's see what we can do.
Yeah. Like, I'm not competent. Like, yeah, I'm sure I could hop on GarageBand and do it, but it's like, it's not going to be the outfit that I want. And I literally think of the music as an outfit. Like, yes, I'm the poem. And then I got to put on like my fucking favorite, like Rick Owens, you know, outfit. Like, and that's how I feel, you know, what the music does for me. You know what I mean? Like, it gets to like present me or my work in the way that, like, I guess I want to be seen and heard.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of like how you want to be seen and heard, like, let's back up a little bit. So first of all, Vanessa Errico, what were you like as a child? I'm so curious.
This is, we need to get Mama Laura on the podcast.
Oh, I would love to have your mom on the podcast. Let's get her in here and be like, please describe Vanessa's behavior.
So, you know, the first thing that comes to mind when I think of childhood is all the weird things I did. I'm the youngest of three. You know, my parents are married. There was five of us, you know, in the household. Like, I had a great family life. You know, I couldn't have asked to be born to better people. I really couldn't, like, I feel like my mom and dad and I were, like, meant to be together. Like, when you talk about soulmates, it's like I somehow chose them or they chose me or something. Like, it couldn't have been a better fit. Like, I'm very, very grateful. And I know that that is such a privilege that a lot of people, you know, don't get to experience. When I think of childhood, the first thing that comes to mind is the very first dream I ever remember having. And this dream has stayed with me my whole life, and I think it is kind of the underlying, I don't know, theme of my existence, maybe. So, I mean, I had to have been so young. I want to say six, but, like, who knows, it could have been before or after. But it's literally the first dream I can remember having. So I grew up in Arlington, Texas. I lived on this corner house, brick house, big tree in the front yard. And I had a friend, Adria, that lived across the street. And I always went to Adria's house. And in the dream, everything looked exactly as it did in real life. Like, there was nothing out of place. There was nothing different in the dream world versus real world. And in the dream, I'm walking back to my house from Adria's house. And as I get to my yard, a man comes from behind the brick mailbox with a knife. And I kind of remember running back to Adria's, and then I remember looking back and I could see my mom standing at the glass door. It was like a glass screen door before, like, the actual door. And she's standing there. I can see my mom clearly. And I'm just running towards her going, "It's just a dream. It's just a dream. It's just a dream." And then I wake up. And there isn't a day that goes by that I do not think about this dream, or that I don't write about it or somehow try to interpret it in every possible way. And I can remember, like, after having that dream, I put on, like, I called it a play. I did a reenactment of this dream with, like, a friend, and I would stand on this big brick mailbox of mine with a rubber knife, and my friend was standing on the ground, and, like, the neighbors would walk by, and I made them pay a quarter to watch my play, and I would, like, attack my friend with this rubber knife.
Did you get attacked in the dream, or were you just, like, really following the storyline through?
He was coming for me. He was attacking me. Like, I don't ever remember, like, seeing his face or, like, getting blood on me, but it was, like, the man came from behind the mailbox with the knife to attack me. That was, like, the point of the... But the fact that I, in my dream, was telling my mom, "It's just a dream, it's just a dream." And I've also been a lucid dreamer since a very young age. So I'll have sleep paralysis where it's like I'm awake, but I can't move. I also know that I'm dreaming a lot, and I always pinch myself on my cheek, and my cheek feels very numb, and I wake myself up. I've done that my whole life. But there's just something about this dream that, like, won't leave me. So when I think of childhood, I definitely think of that dream. You know, like, I did a little play. My friend and I would, like, make these paintings, and I would sell them door to door. I, you know, always was making bead jewelry.
Always, you know, on that hustle.
I was, right? Like, I always remember being creative. Like, but I also remember, like, being alone a lot, even though, like, I had siblings, I had friends. Like, I remember, like, collecting rocks and then, like, bringing my rocks home and, like, looking at them while I watched, like, David the Gnome. I had a birthday party in, like, fourth grade or something at the park. And I brought, like, a black cricket home from the park and made a house for it out of Lincoln logs. Like, I was a weirdo. Like, who does that?
I don't know. Kids are fucking weird in general, but it's curious to me how you've been trying to create framework throughout your entire life, like trying to create context, or I guess really kind of psychoanalyze the context of just about anything, right? From this bizarre dream that's carried with you your whole life to, well, I mean, this cricket's outside, and who wants to be outside? Let's build him a house, you know? Like, I think it's very tender and sweet. But, like, how did you being this kind of, like, avant-garde from the beginning, also, you know, dollar bill hustler in your younger years, how did you get to where you are right now then? Like, what role has art played in your life, or how did it lead you to kind of currently where you are creating?
It is a long and winding road. Like I said, I was like, I've always been a writer. I can remember the first time my mom, in an Easter basket, it was like a Lisa Frank spiral notebook, and it was like the pages were purple. And I can remember writing my very first short stories. So I can remember writing short stories before I can remember writing poems. And I can kind of remember these stories that I wrote, and God, I would give anything to have that notebook. But so reading and storytelling was a big part of my family life. My parents both like read books to me every night before bed. And my dad would always tell me these stories, and they always had some kind of moral, but I can just remember him laying in bed with me, telling me these great stories. And so I think a lot of that maybe came from them. You know, my dad's a writer. He's more conservative. He comes from the financial field. So like, he writes about, you know, finance and money and stocks and poker, because he's now this obsessed with poker. So it's like, it's definitely different topics. But like, I think my writing comes from, you know, my dad, and from the attention my parents paid to reading. They're both just avid readers. You know what I mean? So I've always been a big reader. I got off track greatly. So I can remember like writing these short stories. I can remember writing poetry, like desperate love poems in junior high, like on Saturday school. John Sinners, my very first boyfriend, the unrequited love. And I wrote all the lyrics to the Jewel song, You Were Meant for Me, and these I Love You poems, Why Don't You Love Me, like drama.
Oh, Jewel. You brought us all to ourselves.
And then in high school, every single notebook, it was just all about boys. When I think about the amount of time I wasted and the amount of writing and the amount of thought I wasted on boys, like, makes me so angry. Like,
why do you refer to it as wasted?
It was pointless. Like, why wasn't I focused on me? Like, why wasn't I like writing poetries and stories and trying to figure out, like, why wasn't I reading, you know, I don't know. Like, I did drugs and I was obsessed with boys. That was high school. Like, I feel like my output was nothing, and I have none of those journals because it was just about boys. Like, there was nothing substantial. Like, there was nothing interesting. Like, I, you know, like, I try not to have regrets about my life, but it's like, I feel like it was such a waste. Like,
the only person who doesn't have regrets is too young to have regrets. I remember going all through my 20s being like, I'm never going to regret any of this. And then in my late 30s, I'm like, there's like 6 tattoos I would definitely not get again. And
oh,
also,
God, I know.
Like, I have plenty of regrets, but I have perspective to have wanted to have spent my time more intentionally. But like, yes. I mean, I think that it's interesting that you feel this way, because as an artist, it's like, how will you learn about yourself if not by the environment with which you are immersed, right? So like,
well, this is how I've justified, like, I was busy living my life, right? Like, you know, Arthur Rimbaud is my favorite poet, right? Like, he wrote his masterpiece at 19, right? Like, I am 38 and still have not. So I think a lot
Bukowski
of...
Bukowski worked at the fucking post office for 10 years and stopped writing. Like, we all...
Like, I'm so over that, but like, it did guide me. Like, when I think about, like, I wasn't born a genius. I wasn't a prodigy. Like, you know, I've had to work to be where I am. But I also do realize the value of living my life, because doing a lot of drugs, having sex, getting in trouble, there isn't anything like I don't have to have a midlife crisis, right? Like, I don't have to cheat on my partner and go like, I've never slept with anybody. I've never traveled. You know what I mean? All these people in these long-term relationships realize like, oh, I never did anything growing up. And so like, I listen to these stories of these women in like their late 30s and 40s who are just now experiencing everything I've done. Like, I like that. I like that I'm, when I got in trouble, it didn't dramatically damage my life, right? Because I wasn't an adult. And I'm thankful for living my life, right? I wasn't analyzing like in school. I wasn't learning it in a textbook. Like, this is all firsthand fucking experience, right? Like, and I guess I can look at it as material for everything now that I'm sitting with. I don't know, but it's like, I was really hard on myself for a long time that like, I wasn't smarter. Like, I'm a late bloomer, you know, like, why wasn't I reading this book? Why didn't I know these things? Like, why didn't I come to the realization sooner? You know what I mean? Mm. Like, I made so many bad life choices, so many, like, I'm so embarrassed of like so many ways. Ashley's pointing at himself. there's so many. I'm just mad at myself because I hold myself and the people that I'm around to high standards, and I know that. And high standards, not like, oh, you got the degree and you have money and you're, you know, no, like, it's just like genuine, like, artistic value or just like honesty. Like, I don't really know what it is, but it's like I'm embarrassed of who I used to be, and I hate that I have to carry that around. Like, that I wasn't aware sooner of who I was.
I think some of us come into this experience very sure of certain things. And I think some of us have to wander around and figure it out. I think that's something that you and I have in common. You know, I recently was asked, what did you want to be when you grew up? And I was like, a writer. And they're like, how did you know that? Because you're a writer now. And I'm like, well, like, I'm not the writer I thought I would be. You know what I mean? Like, as a young person, I was really drawn in to the world of books. Like, that was the thing we could afford to do, was go to the library. Mm-hmm. And the library was the place where everything was available to me. And that was my first kind of experience at like binge shopping was like, ooh, I could take home all these library books. And I would consume. And I think that all of those experiences just sat with me as maybe fodder for later. I don't know, but that's what I was deeply interested in. And the same thing is true for anybody I read, anybody I emulated, and even figuring out how to be a writer. And I'm very much air quoting writer because, I don't know if I think writers are born or made. I've watched people go through intense academic studies and come out of those really refined writers. I don't know if I would say talented, but they have a skill set now. And then I've met people who have no college education, no history in literature, who, you know, barely read through their childhoods, who are the most profound writers I've ever experienced. And those people, to me, always seem to be looking out, observing the world, and then bringing it back in and asking what it says to them about them. How can they relate? How were they impacted? Where were they standing in the full scope of the story? And is it third person? Is it first person? Is it not about you at all? And you work all these details into a character that is, for all intents and purposes, fiction. Like, I think we all have a path of picking up these experiences and then deciding how they inform our work. I don't know if any writer was ever just like came into the world with all the writing that they needed to say. You know what I mean? Right. It's hard to really compare like our youthful experiences to Rimbaud's. Like, we didn't grow up with that shit. We didn't grow up with that kind of environment. And maybe he wrote his masterpiece at 19 because life expectancy was 35 and he was halfway to it. You know what I mean? Like, maybe you and I in our various and pretty drastically different ways of being raised as kids. I mean, maybe the freedom of our childhoods was just picking everything up, touching it, tasting it, smelling it for the first time, and like keep or toss. Like, I think that you and I are the kind of people that got to get our hands in shit to decide how we feel about things. So when you tell me you carry these regrets around, almost of like wasted time or wasted energy on things that don't matter, I think it's important to acknowledge that, like, if you were just coming to, I don't know, experimentation with drugs or your sexuality or any other aspect of you right now, you probably wouldn't have created two albums before this. Right. Like, there's just, there's no way to know, but like everything that you've done, seen, experienced flavors what you create. And I mean, is there a good time to experience things over others? Should we leave certain aspects of life out? Like, I would definitely love to have less violence in my history as far as violence that's been enacted on me and my body. But even to those things, they inform the nature of my work. They inform the nature of my own rebellion. And right. So I think that you would absolutely not be the same edgy Vanessa if you hadn't jumped into all these pools just to see what it felt like.
Right. Man, I'm telling you, over the last like 5 years, like, I feel like I've really kind of come in to myself as a writer, as an artist. It's funny. I like to tell this story. I was still in my like early mid 20s or something, and my brother was in town. I'm living back at my parents' house. Like I moved in and out of their house so many times. And I was crying. It was some kind of, you know, relationship boy saga drama. And I remember my brother coming up into my room and looking at me, and I've probably told this story before, but he was like, "You can't act like this. It's not like you're some great artist or something." And I was like, "Yes, I am. Like, what are you talking about?" Like, it hit me that, like, oh, like, people don't see me the way that I see me. And then I realized, like, well, I don't have anything to show for it, that I'm like some great, it wasn't like I had any work I was producing, like, mm-hmm. But it's just like the first time I was really kind of like shook into like, oh, my perception of myself is not what, how other people are perceiving me. Right. And it's hard, especially in your family too, because they see you from that young child and growing up, and they never really let you fully be who you are, you know, because they just know a different part of you and they know too much of you. And I think it's hard to really see a family member as an artist separate from like maybe who you've known your whole life. You know what I mean? So it's like,
sure,
you know, and I have very supportive family, and they come to my poetry readings, and of course they love and support me. But it's like, you know, the idea of me being the black sheep or the fuck up or like the embarrassment, you know, like I still kind of feel like I know it's my own bag I carry around. You know, my parents are like, you know, we don't think about that stuff at all. Like, what are you talking about? Like, they're my biggest champions. But I also kind of think of it in terms of like, I had to let go of like a best friend of 25 years. And I could no longer continue to be some person, some like, that she was like creating in her head that like wasn't me. You know what I mean? That's like, I had to sever that last tie to like my past and like who I was, and I had to do it. I had to do it to be healthy, to be happy, to move on. I can't let other people create my reality for me. And I can no longer continue to be an old version of myself to please somebody else, you know, to continue a relationship that like probably should have ended a long time ago. Like, it just wasn't compatible anymore. Like, am I friends with this person because I like this person? Or am I friends with this person because like we've been best friends since we were 12, and it's repetition and it's addiction, and like, I don't even know why.
Absolutely. I think that that's something that I have been very specifically like writing on, kind of keeping notes on lately, because, you know, we both lost big relationships around the same time, which is like then when we found each other. And I think in trying to articulate on the page, particularly, that you're going to lose everybody you love in an effort to grow, right? There are some people that we allow to anchor us to our history. In your instance, it's your immediate nuclear family, right? Like, you will always be identified, labeled, attached to these people, but you can also step outside of their judgments, their experiences of you, and still be an artist. And then there are people who formulate their understanding of you in the experiences that they have, how you make them feel, and also who you were in the time that you met them. And I think we both have experienced these relationships refusing to untie you from a former anchor and either let you go or attach you to something new that's more relevant and timely and more of an honest perspective of who you are now. Mm-hmm. And I had to leave my former relationship, my former friendship, because I am trying to grow beyond what we have become. And in order for me to do that, I'm going to go. You don't get to keep me here. Are you coming with me or right. not? Is your journey leading you up the same mountain across the same terrain as me? Or is your journey leading you in a different direction? Because I'm not going to stay here mm-hmm. because that's where you're comfortable understanding me. Right. So when people have conflict with like, well, you know, you say you feel this way, but you X, Y, Z in the past. And it's like, well, I agree. In the past, I have been a less informed version of myself. I dare say a shittier version of myself. Mm-hmm. And every effort I make to become a healed, more productive, kinder person, that requires that I let go of something that's preventing that from occurring. And at some point, everybody is going to come up against this question of like, is this person, are these people allowed to stay? And like, the answer is no. You know, there, most people you love are not going to stick around for this future journey.
Losing, I think, a best friend is almost harder than losing like a romantic partner, because that was the one constant I had in my life. That was a really big deal for me to step away from that. Like, that's huge. So, yeah, when I think of, I kind of want to tie this back in, because so Simone de Beauvoir is another, like, one of my favorite writers. And so she's a French philosopher. And, you know, she wrote a book called Eye for an Eye, and she talks about revenge a lot. And the ambiguity of revenge, right? Like, the uncertainty and how many different interpretations of revenge. And she said something really amazing about her. I kind of want to quote it because...
By all means.
Okay. So in Eye for an Eye, she argues that revenge appeals to people, since it's something that retains a whiff of magic that strives to satisfy some unknown dark god of symmetry. I love this idea of dark god of symmetry. Like, people are seeking this justice, right? This vengeful god that we all know from the Bible, this eye for an eye. Well, you know, you hurt me, so now I'm going to hurt you. But she talks about, like, true revenge emerges spontaneously. It is a metaphysical demand which has no goal outside itself. And I love that, because it's almost like this karmic, universal, like, retribution, right? It's like something that happens, this spontaneous thing that emerges to avenge you or something, right? Or to punish the person. Because, you know, she talks a lot about, like, whatever our justice system looks like, right? The law and the cops and the judge and the trial and all that. It's like, really, justice is not really justice when it's within the same fucking container, right? Like, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house, you know, as Audre Lorde said. And I kind of look at it that way too. Like, I like this idea of, like, this spontaneous revenge. Like, I don't even know what that means, but I love thinking about stuff like that. You know, like, when we think of the great works on revenge, right? Hamlet, Shakespeare. There's so many things that come into play. Like, Camus, I've mentioned him before, is one of my, you know, one of my great thinkers that I look to, you know, and his absurdity when we talked about on the Bourdain episode. Like, suicide is, like, the one only great big main question, right? The absurdity of, like, being alive, the absurdity that, like, we're all just gonna die, right? The myth of Sisyphus by Camus, the image of that man constantly just rolling that rock up the mountain, you know, that's the eternal recurrence, that's the, you know, the repetition, right? So the only serious question, as Camus points, is about suicide. Is life worth living, right? And in Hamlet, you know, should he avenge his father's death, right? But he also, his monologue, to be or not to be, that is the question. He's now questioning, like, do I take myself out of the equation? Do I just commit suicide? And is that better than, you know, killing somebody for killing my dad, right? It's almost like, you know, he says, to be or not to be, that is a question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, right? Like, so contemplating the revenge rather than, like, exacting the revenge. There's lots of thinking about revenge going on in Hamlet. And I started to think about, like, revenge as inaction rather than a conscious action that you take, right? And then when I tie that in with, like, our justice system and our trial system, like, the modern day trial, like, in a court, is like the long contemplation of Hamlet's revenge. And back to Simone de Beauvoir, she talks about it's delayed and unsatisfying. So, like, really, in the end, even if the killer is locked up away, this long delay of this trial, of this contemplation, of this dissection, it's not really satisfying. And how, in the end, any kind of justice and revenge is ultimately never really satisfying. And I'm just really curious now about this spontaneous emergence of revenge that has no goal outside of itself. As
well, like, we're seeking balance as we identify our justice system. Fuck our justice system.
Right,
but
right.
In the realm of justice being served, it's the balance, right? An eye for an eye. It's like these two things are equal, and now that we both have them, it's done. But it never satiates the human experience. It never is enough to have what's been done to me done to another person, because then the blood is on both of your hands, right? This notion of like, I have redeemed what's been wronged in me, but I still carry around the pain of what's been wronged in me.
Right. I've been writing a lot about the language of violence, and it's about the language of violence uses women as punctuation. So a lot of it is about violence against women, right? So whether it's personal violence, whether it's historical violence, like I incorporate a lot of things in this work. And it's some pieces I read for your poetry, These Confessing Animals, that you put together for the Fringe Festival, that just to seek to understand. So for your abuser to learn a new language is what I said, like, to all the abusers, may they learn a new language. Because physically punching someone in the head, I'm even thinking of that as a language. Like, this is how you communicate, right? By physical violence. And they never really tend to see what they're doing is wrong. Right. So it's like, do I want them to be punched in the face? Do I want them to be raped? Do I want them to be harmed and locked away? Like, is that revenge? Would that make us feel better? You know, so revenge is like outside authority, right? Like, you as an individual, like, take up, like, you're going to do it because you know the system isn't going to do it, because justice retribution is governed by our state and our laws and like these rules of the game that are all fucked up anyways, right? So it's like, you know, I read this headline of this woman who kills her husband by throwing like boiling water on him for like molesting her child. Bravo. You know, right. I think of Lorena Bobbitt, who cut home dude's dick off and threw it out the window.
Right.
Bravo.
Out the window.
Like, I'm surprised more women don't cut dicks off. I really am. And it's like, because the violence that we have endured historically, systemically, individually, in the house, in society, is so great. And, you know, when I think of like these individual acts of, you know, when the young girl who was stolen and sex trafficked and she has the opportunity, she kills her captor, like, she should never go to jail. Like, are those acceptable revenge? What is acceptable violence?
Truly. Well, and to back up even more, because when we were doing research for this kind of conversation around revenge and redemption, revenge is Webster's Dictionary quotes revenge as, oh my God, an action of inflicting harm or damage on someone else in retaliation for harm or damage inflicted on you. So even if you put someone through physically, let's say, a full recreation of what they put you through physically, revenge and retaliation are inextricably twined. They are forever synonymous. They mean the same thing. And revenge is sexier because it's more philosophical, right? Revenge has many tentacles. But retaliation, if you replace revenge with retaliation takes on a much more visceral, tangible element. And it suggests that you're going to do no more and no less than what was done to you. Revenge can carry on forever, right? Revenge is, I mean, Beyonce is like, revenge, the best revenge is getting your paper, right? And
right.
It's like, well, if I'm never rich and successful, does that mean I never got my revenge? Or am I only operating from a mode of revenge? Because again, back to the research, I was looking at like the most popular literary revenge stories. And the first one to come up repeatedly was Homer's Iliad. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the summary is that one dude's taking revenge on another dude for stealing his wife and like that's how this whole thing is going to start, right? Like every story that involves romance often involves like a slighted lover, someone right. who was taken away. And is there ever really any revenge that satisfies humiliation? Is there any revenge that satisfies the robbery? Because what's taken from you can never be replaced. And I think we have this fucked up notion that committing an act of revenge will somehow satiate mm-hmm. the pain and suffering that you've endured. And there is no way to guarantee that the perpetuator of the initial violence will ever truly understand or grasp what they've done to you. Revenge is personal. We don't call it the revenge system. We call it the justice system, because the justice system is a collective of all of us deciding to come to, well, first of all, deciding that no one of us can make a decision about this. So we have to have a majority. That way, the blood is only a little on all of our hands instead of entirely on one of our hands, right?
Right.
And we have in some ways decided, in some places in our country, decided that violence will only beget more violence. So that is not a solution. And then, but I don't know how often people take that road as opposed to enacting revenge in some other way, right? Like, do we make justice non-personal and a collective effort, and revenge is a deeply personal, singular effort? And mm-hmm. how do we balance all of that out within our complex human experience, which is why I think Baroque was the perfect word, because it's a movement and it's ornate mm-hmm. and it's complex. And therefore, perhaps revenge does involve all of us.
I think a lot of writers write to, like, in order to talk and have conversations with, like, other writers and artists, right? Like, we want to be in conversation, like, in order to find our people, to be part of, like, a larger, you know, conversation, whether it's, like, the literary milieu or, like, whatever. It's, like, our way to have access to other thinkers, to kind of, like, put a call out to, like, bring people to you, right? Like, I go looking for all these answers and all these books of all these great writers that, you know, have come before me, and I feel less lonely. I look for ideas, you know, I want to be part of the conversation. And I think that's what I'm doing with a lot of my work.
Well, it sounds like we've come to a conclusion, I think, today, where revenge is the collective questioning, you know, what is right? What is the balance? What is the appropriate punishment for these crimes we've collectively dubbed as unacceptable in the society we live in? And the problem that we're presented in our society is there's always a caveat of exclusion. Someone's allowed to get away with it, but someone else isn't. And, you know, I didn't know when we started talking about this subject of revenge that it was going to, like, slit the belly of revenge, and that retaliation was going to fall out, vengeance was going to fall out, the importance or the irrelevance of revenge, you know, where does justice fall into this conversation? Like, this is such a bigger subject than we could have possibly fleshed out.
I know we slit the belly of revenge. Damn, you always do that.
I can't help it. I'm a writer.
Oh God, you're a good thinker too, and you're quick. You're quick. So
that's because you're exposing me to all these philosophies that I completely ignored in college.
I know, but like you bring such fresh perspective. I love having these conversations with you because it does. Because the point isn't coming to some answer. There's no fucking answer. If someone had an answer, like, we wouldn't be where we're at, right? But like, I think part of doing the work is having these conversations and having these ideas, and like, we just keep it keeps just getting bigger, right? We're like, oh yeah, like revenge and redemption, like, it could seem so cut and dry, but look at the universe that we just opened up.
Yeah. So tune in next week, guys, and gals, and everyone in between, and we'll talk about redemption and see what falls out of our mouths then. Thanks for being my primary guest today. And I think we owe you more of a very specific interview. But then again, everybody's learning about us all the time. So thanks for taking on revenge and bringing all these elements into it for us to discuss today.
Yeah, thank you for holding the space and bringing the good questions and, you know, being my ears and my sounding board and my collaborator. And really excited to see what you bring with Redemption next week.
Girl, you know I love you. To listen to Vanessa's, to listen to Human Animal and the Midnight Rush, go to vanessaarico.bandcamp.com. We'll drop the link in the show notes. And please subscribe to our Patreon. You guys have already heard everything that you need to hear about it, but go check it out. ConfessingAnimals.com. Oop, nope, just kidding. Is it ConfessingAnimalsPodcast.com?
I think it's ConfessingAnimalsPodcast.com.
Yeah, and Patreon.com/ConfessingAnimalsPodcast.
We'll get it right one of these days.
Thanks for being here, guys.
Bye. If you want to get access to the full interview, which includes 3 more poems and an hour more conversation, please join us at patreon.com/ConfessingAnimalsPodcast.